Thanks for listening to the Best of Outkick the Coverage podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, 3 to 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for Outkick the Coverage at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every morning on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
This is the Best of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis on Fox Sports Radio.
Yesterday, we talked a decent amount about the decision of the NFL to partner with Jay-Z. Yesterday, I got the Wall Street Journal. Jay-Z had sat down. He had talked with the NFL. They had been secretly meeting with him since January. The idea is that Jay-Z is basically going to head up their social justice outreach program that the NFL owners and the NFL players have put in place in an idea, a goal to make the world a better place, right? That's a very desirable goal. I don't think there's anybody out there who's like, yeah, I hate the idea of the NFL making the world a better place. What is interesting here is that Jay-Z, as part of analyzing his decision to join this this organization, the NFL, he said something that I think is really intriguing. And I know he's gotten some blowback. As soon as this story went up yesterday, he started to get blowback because we live in a very sort of ridiculous time, I would say. And one of the things we live in that is that's a little bit broken is the idea that you shouldn't interact with people who have different political opinions than you and different sporting opinions or whatever it is that kind of spiraled out of the Colin Kaepernick protest. And this quote from Jay-Z, I want to give it more attention than I think it's maybe received from anybody else. Jay-Z was asked about getting involved with the NFL. This is in the Wall Street Journal. Even though he may not agree with the politics of some of his new business partners, NFL team owners. Here's what Jay-Z said, and I'm reading directly from the Wall Street Journal. I'm black. That's my world. He also said, if he didn't do business with wealthy business interests who he may disagree with politically, he said, then I couldn't have any TV shows. I couldn't put my platform on TV because I'm sure someone who owns the broadcast network has supported someone who I don't believe should be in office. I can't control, no one can control the world that we live in currently and people's choice to vote self-interest. And so as a result, this is pretty fascinating to me because Jay-Z is going to be criticized for interacting with the NFL. What Jay-Z represents, even if you're not a fan of Jay-Z's music, and I am a fan of Jay-Z's music, is the ultimate capitalistic triumph of America. Okay? And the NFL also represents the ultimate sporting capitalism triumph of America. So to me, it makes sense that a mogul like Jay-Z, who has built his career from nothing through his connection to his audience through music, would be attracted to a league like the NFL where all of the players and the managers and the owners and the GMs and everybody else have built their audience in the world of sports to a bigger platform than has ever existed before. And what both of them have in common is they have fundamentally flourished in a capitalistic democracy. And the way a capitalistic democracy works is it requires that you interact with people who you might not agree with all the time. Yesterday, we had Dan Wetzel on the show, and Dan Wetzel made a good point. He said, hey, if you were going out to dinner, and before you went out to dinner, you said, hey, I'm Christian, but I refuse to go out to dinner with somebody who might be Muslim or Jewish or Hindu, you would be, by most people, I think, ridiculed. Because people would say, well, just because you're going out to dinner with somebody, and even though you disagree with them on religion, doesn't mean that you guys have to agree on every single thing. You can still break bread together and have conversations. And indeed, it's likely that even if you disagree on religion, which is pretty important to a lot of people around this world, you can still find common ground other places. And by the way, the same would be true if somebody was Muslim and they said they wouldn't go eat with a Christian or a Jew or anything else, right? The religion doesn't matter here. So don't people hopping on Twitter, like pointing out the particular religions. My point is that common face-to-face interaction is an integral part of all human relationships. And I feel like we're in this strange era where if you have a different political opinion than someone else, you feel like you shouldn't even interact with them. And in fact, on social media, this whole idea of the cancel culture is that you should try and cancel people who you disagree with. You should take away their ability to have to make a living. You should take away their ability to provide for their family. If somebody has a difference of opinion than you and they share it and you get upset with it, you go to war with them. This happens all the time with mobs on the internet. What I find fascinating about Jay-Z and the owners is Jay-Z is expressly saying here, we don't agree on everything, but we can still unite potentially to find some common good. And what I also find intriguing about this is an idea that I would float for this initiative. There's a lot of talk right now about trying to change things, right? I want to change this institution, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. I want to tear down this institution. I want to alter the paradigm. I want to be a destructive force, right? There are very few things that are really trusted in American society today. And that's one reason why I think sports is so important, because it unites us all and it connects us all. And whether you love or hate Donald Trump, he is a change agent trying to change things oftentimes that he thinks are broken. And the people who are running to oppose Donald Trump are also change agents who all want to destroy things, right? Like they want to tear down existing structures. What I try to focus on instead of huge seismic goals is something that is very tangible and that is reachable. And to me, that oftentimes has to do with an individual decision-making idea. So Jay-Z and Roger Goodell meet face-to-face, and they end up deciding, you know what, we can be a partners here, we can make things better. And a lot of people out there are going to say, well, the last thing I want is for anybody to be involved in the political process while sports is involved. And I understand that. And in fact, Jay-Z even seems to understand that it's ultimately bad for business, because Jay-Z came out and said that he hopes that Kaepernick will have a platform where he can express himself and maybe it doesn't have to take place on the field. So Jay-Z, even though he is black and many of the NFL owners are white, they speak a common language based on a common color, and that color is green. Ultimately, what is good for business leads to more money. And what's always fascinated me about this NFL dispute, as it has played out over the past several years, is the players and the owners are not warring factions here. They're not two different tribes trying to fight with each other. They're actually all people who are on a boat trying to keep the boat from sinking and hoping that one day they can move to a bigger boat, right? And what I mean by that is, from a pure business perspective, the owners keep 53% of all NFL revenue right now. The players keep 47%. The idea that the players didn't really seem to understand was, in order to maximize revenue, you have to avoid antagonizing your primary client base. The owners, I don't believe, are opposed to the political opinions of the players. They were opposed to whatever cost them money. NFL ratings dropped 19% over 2 years. The owners and the players seem to have recognized that was a bad thing, and they seem to be trying to rectify it. But the thing that very few people understand, because they don't think like Jay-Z, because they don't think like NFL owners, most people think like employees, and most players think like employees, is that ultimately the way to solve a lot of issues is to make everybody more money. And they're not fighting over a slice of pie. They're trying to make the pie bigger. And so what I am thinking of here is maybe a radical idea, but I want to float it out for everybody to hear this morning. What I would actually like to see players, owners, GMs, presidents of teams, coaches, leagues get involved in, if they want to get involved in making the world a better place, is don't try and get involved in things that are particularly partisan in nature. For instance, let me give you a couple of examples. Right now, many different NFL teams tell you when you are leaving the stadium to make sure that you buckle your seatbelt. That is not a political statement. Buckling your seatbelt saves lives, right? Regardless of what your color is, regardless of your religion, regardless of your sexual orientation, if you are listening to me right now in your car, I hope you have your seatbelt buckled, because statistically, you are much safer with a buckled seatbelt. Almost every NFL team, in fact, I think every NFL team does it, stops selling beer sometime during the third quarter. And they also encourage all of their fans to not drink and drive. That is not a partisan statement either. If you drink and drive, statistically, you are more likely to hurt yourself, right? I don't think there's anybody out there who would dispute this. When you drink and drive, if you are drunk, you are more likely to be engaged in an accident and to cause problems, injuries for yourself or others. Those are two things that NFL teams do, which are in no way partisan in nature, and they help to make the world a better place. I think the NFL has a really important role right now in American society, because I think, and I think a lot of you are going to agree with me again, and I don't think this is particularly partisan, I think one reason why we have the violence that we have in American society today is because men, and before that, boys, are not raised in a very healthy environment lots of times. And if you have been a young man at any point in your life, as a huge percentage of people who are listening to me right now have been, you know that one of the dumbest ages that has ever existed for any group of people in mankind's history is young men who were like 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22 years old. If you are alive right now and you're over the age of 22, you will look back at some of the things you did when you were 16 to early 20s and say, my God, I was an ignoramus. I was a total and complete idiot. And hopefully you have gained some wisdom along the way, and hopefully you grow up and you'll be a good dad, you'll be a good grandfather, uncle, mentor to younger boys. A lot of people don't have that. And sports for many people is that pathway to adulthood. It's why sports matter in our society. In a fatherless society, so many kids out there look to their coaches as their father figure when you don't have a father at home. You talk to college football coaches, the percentage of broken home kids that they raise is massive, and the number of young boys out there that just don't have a father figure in their life that is reliable or giving them good advice is huge. And if you're not a great athlete, you may not have a great coach in that perspective either, which is why so many athletes become role models for young men and for boys in this country. Okay? I've got something that I wish I could get a huge percentage of athletes, teams, owners, leagues behind that is completely nonpartisan. This is data analytics. I talked about buckling your seatbelt and also not drinking and driving. Those are two things, regardless of what your politics are, you're like, you know what? I think my team saying, wear a seatbelt when you drive home, don't drink and drive, I'm pretty comfortable with that. I don't think that offends anybody's notions of political impartiality. Here are three things that I think are important. And as this platform on this show has grown and we've started to develop a pretty substantial audience, not massive yet, it's going to be massive one day. It's pretty substantial now. Three things that I'm going to drive home over and over and over again, because the number of young boys who are out there listening to me now in the morning, going into school, school season about to start again, you're out and about all over the country, it's pretty substantial. And the number of dads with young kids out there, pretty substantial. Moms too. But I think boys in particular are oftentimes getting bad messages in our society today. They're sort of constrained and they don't feel like they're getting the unvarnished truth a lot of times. I think that is why that's so much kind of underground anger that exists for young men. Three things that I wish athletes, teams, owners, and leagues could get behind that are nonpartisan and are guaranteed to make a big difference in our society. I'm going to tell you those three things right now. Number one, graduate from high school. Everybody wants to be rich in this country, at least if you buy into the capitalistic doctrine, you do. But one of the big challenges I think that exists in general, I think one of the big challenges that exists in general, as I'm preaching a little bit this morning, is before you can be rich, you have to not be poor, right? And that doesn't sound very complicated, but if you haven't had money before, you're nodding along. You're like, I'd like to be rich, but first I'd like to not be poor. I can't guarantee anybody out there is going to be rich one day. But here are three things that if you do this, statistically, all of the data in America reflects your poverty rate will be basically zero. graduate from high school. These are individual decisions that every single one of my listeners can manage. If you are listening to me this morning, you can graduate from high school. And your kids can graduate from high school. And your future kids can graduate from high school. That is something you can accomplish. Not saying you have to get a PhD in astrophysics. I'm not saying you have to go and get a medical degree. I'm saying you need to be able to graduate from high school. Two, don't have a kid before you are 25 years old. If you wait until you are 25 to have your first child and you graduate from high school, your chances of being poor are minuscule. All right? Really, really, really low. I'd love to hear athletes going into schools everywhere and tell kids, graduate from high school, don't have a kid until you're at least 25 years old. And here's the third step. And if you do all three of these, you have a poverty rate in America today, regardless of what you're born into, regardless if you're born poor, regardless if you're born rich. If you do this third thing as well, you will not be poor. Can't guarantee you're going to be rich. I can guarantee you're not going to be poor. Don't have a kid till you get married. Graduate high school. Don't have a kid before 25. Don't have a kid until you get married. And obviously you need to get a job in there somewhere as well, but that's kind of, you understand that. You can't just do nothing. But if you do those three things, and if you want to add a job, I'll be the four things that every single person on the planet can manage, you will not be poor in this country. To me, that's almost the equivalent of telling you to buckle your seatbelt. That's almost the equivalent of telling you not to drink or drive. Instead of trying to enact major systemic change, if you individually enact that change in your life, you can make a big difference in your own life. And in so doing, if you reduce the rates of poverty in this country, many of our societal ills begin to diminish. Those three things, or those four things, if you want to call it. This is me preaching to you. I'd love to see the NFL, Jay-Z, the leagues actually get involved in that, as opposed to deciding to get involved in partisan political issues.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
Let me go ahead and bring in Dr. David Chow at Pro Football Doc on Twitter. We have got so many questions for you as the NFL preseason continues to play out. And I want to start with this Andrew Luck drama. There are a lot of people out there listening to us right now who are Indianapolis Colts fans, and they're like, oh no, this is like a bad horror film all over again. We had the injury situation that played out a couple of years ago where the Colts kept updating us, and then boom, he never ends up playing. Give us a sense. A lot of fantasy football people out there, a lot of people gambling on sports futures. Andrew Luck, how serious is this?
Well, you know, I wish I had all the answers. By listening to GM Chris Ballard, he outright says the Colts don't have all the answers. Now, obviously, it started with now a calf injury, a calf strain that started in March. By May, when it should be better, wasn't better. There was an injection to try and test it, and it didn't relieve all the pain. They decided to wait, and come training camp, it flared up again, was shut down, and talk even in the last few days of Ostrigonum that came from their owner, Jim Irsay, that's now been put out of the sphere of possibilities, and Achilles has been ruled out. But what is it now? It's a calf strain that has now become an ankle issue. Quoting Chris Ballard, high ankle-ish, not exactly traumatic high ankle plastic sprain, but the pain is anterior in the quote high ankle area, but in the next sentence it causes pain posteriorly. So what do we make of all this? Clay, I wish I could be more exact. I mean, I'm on the outside. I haven't examined Andrew Luck. Eventually the story may come clear here, but here's what we know from the outside. That is clearly lingered. It is clearly gone on for 5 months. It indeed may have morphed. Who knows? Is it myositis ossificans, some other different process, a stress fracture injury? Who knows? But at this point, it's clearly lingered for 5 months. Their plan is to alter but continue rehab. The season for week one is 3.5 weeks away. Let's use some logic here. After 5 months, Is 3.5 weeks of alter rehab going to get him to 100%? The answer is clearly no. Now, can he play and be effective at 85%? Maybe. Will he play at 85%? By some of his shoulder comments of, look, I've learned to be honest with myself and everybody else, and I'm not doing that to myself again. Admittedly, it's his lead leg, not his push-off leg, maybe less important. It's not his shoulder. But with the lessons learned before, if he's not 100%, will Andrew Luck even want to push it? So there's a lot of unknowns, but what we do know is he will not be 100% week one.
Beyond a shadow of a doubt so far, what is it fair to say this is the biggest injury storyline in the offseason, and there's probably not a close second in terms of its impact on the season?
Well, I think we're all prisoners of the moment. This week, today, Thursday morning, clearly Andrew Luck is the biggest storyline. Last week, Thursday morning, I would have said it was Antonio Brown and his feet. And throughout the summer, I might have said it was Todd Gurley and his arthritic knee. So it is ever-changing landscape in terms of the injury forefront.
What do you think? Let's go. So that's the Andrew Luck update for everybody out there with the Colts. And we'll continue to talk with you. And by the way, you're going to be joining us weekly, which is going to be fantastic, at ProFootballDoc on Twitter. You can also follow Dr. David Chow there. He updates you throughout the week and throughout the days with all of the latest information on NFL injuries, whether it's for fantasy sports or gambling purposes, or you're just a fan of one particular team or one particular player and you want the latest there. Let's go to Antonio Brown. What, if anything, did you learn based on what we saw on Hard Knocks? What do you think is actually going on with his feet?
Well, kind of what we talked about before. I mean, he had some sort of trench foot / excess moisture that started to seep into his feet. And as a result of that, when he went into the cryotherapy chamber, it's not true frostbite where your toes turn black, but the wet, macerated soles of his feet sort of froze, and then he got this freezer burn type thing, not true frostbite. And we talked about it. It's like licking, if your tongue is moist and you lick the flagpole, we've all seen A Christmas Story, right? And that's kind of what happened to him. And then so the outer layer skin had to peel off, and that's what we saw. It's done that for the most part now. I don't know exactly what date that the picture was from Hard Knocks, but clearly it's gotten a lot better, and I think he's close to returning at this point in time.
So at this point in time, you wouldn't be worried at all about his health status as it pertains to playing week one based on his feet injury?
I really haven't been that worried throughout, but no, I'm not worried. I think he will be there week one. Is he going to suit up in preseason game number two? No way. Could he suit up a little bit in week three? I don't know, but he's going to be there week one. Now, how much will the absence, whether from helmet reasons or foot reasons, from the Raiders training camp in terms of getting acclimated to Derek Carr and their new offense, how will that affect him? I don't know, but I think his feet will be fine come the first game of the season.
Used to work with, at the time, the San Diego Chargers. Another big story associated with Antonio Brown has been his preference for a particular helmet. The helmet changes have helped to decline the number of head-related issues. Did you have any sort of empathy for Antonio Brown over his helmet issue? Or as a doctor, is it crazy to you that somebody would want to use an older helmet given the technological advances that have taken place over the past several years?
Yeah, on my Twitter timeline, I wrote an article talking about the silliness about Antonio Brown and his helmet and the truth. So in some ways, you know, there's lots of craziness. In some ways, I think he has a point. The craziness we've all heard, but the craziest thing I've never heard of in my life is taking your own helmet and trying to bootleg paint it like the Raiders and pass it by. That's absolute silliness. Not to mention the fact that he had notice in over a year, and why are we doing this in training camp in terms of the grievance? But in terms of where he's right, even though there are, quote, better tested helmets, helmets were never invented to prevent concussion. And the best helmet cannot prevent concussions. They may be safer in some ways, and I applaud those changes, but it does not take concussion risk to zero. No helmet can. It's like there's no car designed out there that can prevent you from being injured in a car accident. It still can't happen. Of course, there are safer cars. If you take the famous example of this viscous helmet, which is the highest rated one that started in 2017, Brian Cushing wore it, and the very first game, week one, he got a concussion. It wasn't because of the helmet. It was in spite of the helmet. But here's the other thing. If this is this big of a safety concern for the NFL, then why did they, and there was this much of a difference between one helmet and another, and clearly there are superior helmets to a magnitude, then why did they allow the grandfathering? Are they saying they looked the other way for a year? No, clearly it was okay, and they were just having to draw the line somewhere. And now you see the compromise. Okay, you can wear the helmet, but you just have to find one that was manufactured in the last 10 years. And that's not a horrible compromise. So there is some truth to his stance, but the way he went about it seemed kind of silly.
We're talking to Dr. David Chow at Pro Football Doc on Twitter. You mentioned Todd Gurley. We also have Derrick Henry concerns. Which of those two backs, if either, would you be nervous about potentially from a fantasy football standpoint or from a ready-to-go week one standpoint at a full, healthy go?
Well, you know, the Titans are famous and respect to Coach Vrabel for the policy, probably learned from the Patriots, don't say anything about injuries in the preseason. And a calf strain that's fairly acute on a running back alarms me a lot more than a, quote, calf injury. Obviously, it's morphed for Andrew Luck. Than one on a quarterback on their lead leg. So there is some concern there. I would probably, as of today, have more concern about Derrick Henry week one than Todd Gurley. But maybe across 16 seasons, that might become a toss-up or might go the other way in terms of arthritis and wear and tear down the road. I still think Gurley will be effective, but I just don't think he's going to be a bell cow 20-plus touch running back anymore.
What else is out there that people should be aware of from an NFL injury perspective, from a fantasy draft or a gambling on futures perspective that I haven't asked you about?
Well, you know, you got a 4-hour show today.
Three-hour show okay. Every day. Yeah.
I knew it was a 3-hour show. I just said 4 hours for effect. But here's what I would say. Look, Jerick Lee, if you got the preseason injury report that's available on Twitter timeline for free to all Outkick listeners, et cetera, it covers your team, every team, and essentially every player. You would have seen 2 weeks ago I was worried about Jerick McKinnon before the latest setback. You would have seen last week when I updated, I said Demaryius Thomas is, I believe, going to go on PUP to start the season for the Patriots. There's all sorts of nuggets in there for fantasy, for DFS, for season-long wagering, or just getting your wits about you. And things change so much. I tried to put one out at the beginning of the season because it was a lot of work. I was just going to let it sit. Because there's so many changes, I'm updating it. I updated it after the week one preseason games. I'll update it again after the week two and then the week three so people can kind of keep up with what's going on. If you sign up once for free, you'll get the updates automatically. And so you don't have to listen to me for 4 hours.
Drew Brees is 40. Tom Brady is 42. Do you factor in age at all when you try and contemplate injury analysis or risk factors in your profession? You worked with Philip Rivers. He's getting up there in age too. Or do you not even really consider age when you look at trying to figure out whether a guy is healthy or not? How much, if at all, do you factor in age?
Well, I think age is one of the many factors and part of shameless self-promotion here, Clay. This wasn't a setup, but just this week, Philip Rivers was my podcast guest, and he went over all the decision factors into his playing with a torn ACL for that AFC Championship game almost 10 years ago.
Yes.
And you can listen to that. But in any case, yes, age is a factor. The type of player is a factor. The position obviously is a factor. The point in his career, the contractual status, the type of, a strong arm quarterback might be able to overcome an elbow issue. A weak arm quarterback may not. Look, on Andrew Luck's case, what helps him there is at least his lead leg, not his push-off leg, right? So we factor all those things into particular circumstances when you look at injury, but it's too simplistic to say this guy's 42 and so therefore he can't do it. It some of it depends on, the injuries that he's had leading into it and the type of of offense that he's running. So it's a fairly complex answer. Of course, father time gets us all, but I've always said the most important attribute for a successful quarterback is his brain, not his arm strength. If you're consistently having to throw into tight windows, that's where you kind of get in trouble anyways. You can do it on occasion. It's hard to do that regularly. And these quarterbacks that are playing well in the 40s, you know, obviously you mentioned Breeze and Brady, and you look at what Manning did, you know, late in his career, you look at Phillip Rivers, they're doing it with their brains, not just forcing it into a tight window.
Outstanding stuff as always. We'll talk to him every week. It's Dr. David Chow at Pro Football Doc on Twitter. Read what he writes. Follow him on there. Appreciate it, my man.
Thank you.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
It's wild how the Cleveland Browns have gone from the most reviled, disinteresting franchise in almost all of professional sports when Hugh Jackson was there and they couldn't win a game, to Hard Knocks, which I think was an important appetizer to the steak dinner that has become the Cleveland Brown meal. Baker Mayfield being drafted, all of those changes. And the Browns now, maybe outside of the Dallas Cowboys and all of the uncertainty surrounding them, and they still are America's team, and maybe outside of the New England Patriots, if I had to draft a team, I always think this is entertaining. If you had to do a story draft, I do national sports talk radio, so that's great. That means I get to talk about whatever the best stories are in the nation. But before that, I did local sports talk radio. And in local sports talk radio, you are going to talk a lot about your local team. And sometimes your local team stories are awful. Sometimes they're of national interest. Most of the time, they are not. They're local sports stories. And so I still sometimes think about that dichotomy between local sports radio guy who's in a market where the teams are really entertaining and there are great topics, and local sports talk radio guy who's in a market where the teams are incredibly boring and there's nothing interesting to talk about. Because I have been, in my career as a local sports talk radio guy before I did this, in both of those markets. And it makes a tremendous difference. And so sometimes as the NFL season gets closer, or as the NBA season's about to kick off, college football, college basketball, you think about, hey, what are the teams that have the best storylines? And I think if we were doing a draft right now and I opened up the phone lines and I said, okay, you have to draft an NFL team and you can only read and talk about this particular NFL team for the entire season, I think probably the first two picks would be the Dallas Cowboys and the New England Patriots. Because there are a lot of storylines, the Cowboys, what's going to happen with Zeke, what's going to happen with Dak, what's going to happen with Amari Cooper, Jerry Jones is entertaining. The Dallas Cowboys are America's team, so they have a big fan base. With Bill Belichick and Tom Brady, the Patriots are always going to be top-of-the-line attention. Fox has got the Super Bowl this year. We're going to be down doing Lock It In, which, by the way, comes back on Monday, August 19th. We're going to be doing it from Miami, which is where the Super Bowl is going to be going on this year. And as part of that Super Bowl, there will be certainly a lot of hope among the Fox Sports executives and employees that the matchup will be the best possible matchup it could be. And I guarantee if you gave the president of Fox Sports, Aaron Shanks, the opportunity to draft an AFC and an NFC team to play for the Super Bowl, he would pick the Patriots in the AFC and the Cowboys in the NFC, because it would produce the biggest ratings maybe that have ever existed for a Super Bowl, certainly if the game is competitive. But if you couldn't pick those two teams, do you know who'd be the third pick? The Cleveland freaking Browns. The Cleveland Browns would be the number three draft pick on most interesting team to follow this year. And there are probably some of y'all out there right now who say, you know what? I might take them at one or two. And you know who's doing that? CBS. Jim Nantz and Tony Romo are the number one announced team for CBS Sports. Do you know what game they are going to cover week one of the NFL season? The Cleveland Browns. Do you know who the Cleveland Browns are playing? The Tennessee Titans. The Browns are such a big draw right now that even the old, boring Tennessee Titans that nobody cares about are still sexy enough because they're being paired with the Cleveland Browns. I want to bring in my guy, Jason Martin. He's hanging out with me this morning. Former producer. You heard him last week guest hosting. He has his own local radio show. Do you agree with my draft order there? If you had to go 1, 2, 3, you go probably Patriots for me, number one. I think they're more interesting than the Cowboys. Some people probably a little bit tired of the Patriots, but I think overall the number of interest. Cowboys 2, Browns 3. I'm stunned. I saw this news, and I was like, man, they're putting Jim Nance and Tony Romo. In case you wondered how much of a hype train the Cleveland Browns were a part of right now, that eliminates all the doubt completely. That is pretty outstanding.
Yeah, see, I led off with this yesterday on my show in Nashville because I'm in that weird spot where I have a national show on the weekends. I fill in for you, so I do both national and local. So I have to kind of sometimes take my cone and go inward and sometimes go outward. And I look at the Titans as a franchise that's not particularly interesting to cover on a day-to-day basis. So I think I probably cover it less than others. But I heard yesterday across the media, oh, they're doing Browns Titans. I bet some of that has to do with the Browns. Yes, some of it. Like 120%.
Well, that's local people saying that. But yeah, like it's all the Browns, right? I mean, that to me is the most interesting thing about this decision is it's not even the Browns against a good team. Like if the Browns were opening right against the Steelers, let's say, you'd be like, oh, that's a no-brainer, yes, right? Like I want to see what's going to happen with the Steelers, or if the Browns were opening with the Cowboys, or if they were opening with the Patriots, or some team that also has incredible storylines. The Titans are way down the flowchart of interesting teams coming into the season. That might change. We'll see what happens. NFL's great because teams can go and put up really spectacular seasons when you didn't anticipate it. Certainly it happens every year. But the Browns are the driving force here. And if 2 years ago you've been making that suggestion, you would have been laughed out of any radio studio in America.
Yeah. And so I wasn't necessarily I looked at the rest of the schedule for that day and the games that I expect CBS to have. And I could see Nance and Romo being at Colts Chargers. That's a great playoff game. Teams from last year. That is Andrew Luck, maybe. We assume Andrew Luck versus Phillip Rivers. That's a solid game. Then I look at Chiefs-Jags. That's Patrick Mahomes versus Jalen Ramsey. If nothing else, that's as interesting to me if you're looking at it from a football perspective.
I totally agree.
But Browns-Titans, here's the comparison that I made, and you can tell me if you agree with this. It was also announced this week that the New Orleans Pelicans are going to have 30 games on national television this year. 30. That might be more than they've had the entire time they've had the franchise.
It's the Zion factor,
and
right?
This is
it's
all the about Baker, Zion. And this is the Baker Mayfield factor and the, to a little bit lesser degree, Odell Beckham Jr. factor.
Yeah.
There's so much volatility here and there's so much marquee level name recognition with the Browns that they're impossible to deny. And it's a good problem to have because you look at baseball, their guy is Mike Trout, and nobody cares about him because he doesn't care to be out there. Baker Mayfield wants to be out there. Best thing could happen for the NFL is for Baker Mayfield and the Browns to be good this year. Not to be bad, or the worst would be for them to be like a 7-win team.
Yes.
If they're awful,
mediocre is always bad. Like there's a great analogy people say about, for instance, what we do for a living. If you love me, I love you.
Yes.
If you hate me, I love you. If you don't care about anything that I say for 3 hours, then I am failing, right?
Apathy like is
that,
death.
Apathy is, and especially even more so now in a modern media environment. If you don't care about me one way or the other, that's tough. So for Baker Mayfield, you're right. You either want to have the spectacular season where they go out, they win the AFC North, or they contend for it, they make the playoffs, he and OBJ, there's all sorts of different stories associated with it, or you want the spectacular implosion where it's like an accident and you can't look away, right? Either one of those things is a good draw for the NFL. But the fact that they're all in, let me ask you this question. How much of this has to do with Hard Knocks? Because I think Hard Knocks leading into last season was massive for growing the overall fan base of the Cleveland Browns. They were very likable at times. You learned a lot about their internal, you know, sort of employees and the dynamics associated with it. I think Freddie Kitchens is an incredibly likable coach. I certainly think Baker Mayfield is an enigma who provokes reactions. We don't really know that much about Baker Mayfield. He was the same way at Oklahoma, whether it was grabbing his groin or slamming the flag at center field, middle of the field against the Ohio State Buckeyes after a big win, doing the throat slash gesture, I think it was, against Georgia. The guy just provokes reactions one way or the other. And so, but I think getting them on Hard Knocks was massive to creating kind of this groundswell of Cleveland Browns interest.
Yeah, I agree. I think that every year it's really easy to fall into the trap of the team that's on Hard Knocks. Ooh, they're going to have a pretty good season because you watch it all in slow motion and NFL Films is doing all these camera tricks. Every camp looks good when it's through that prism. But the Baker Mayfield thing is Hugh Jackson not giving him a chance and us getting to watch him last year on HBO look pretty good, sound like he knew what he was doing. That made him more endearing. I look at Baker Mayfield.
Made him an underdog.
Yeah, I think Baker Mayfield is a loud, obnoxious version of Drew Brees, potentially right now. Drew Brees is one of the most likable people in the NFL. Baker Mayfield's probably going to be one of the most polarizing guys, where I think Cleveland's going to love him. Everybody in that city is going to be endeared to him, but then everybody else is going to probably have one or the other opinion. You talk about the internet extremes in the first hour. The internet extremes on Baker Mayfield are going to be love or hate. I don't think there's going to be a lot of apathy with Baker Mayfield at any point during his career.
No, I think that's completely correct. I mean, I am utterly fascinated, look, to see what's going to happen in that week one, because I think that one of two things is going to happen. I don't think that the 7-9, 8-8 caliber season, 6-10, 9-7, whatever, is likely to happen with the Browns. I think either they come out of the gate firing on all cylinders and they are white hot and they are contending not just for the AFC North, but potentially for a bye in the playoffs, right, all season long. Or I think Freddie Kitchens is that young first-year head coach. He's not really prepared for things. We know what happens with Odell Beckham Jr. He's going to create a stir at some point. The team really hasn't dealt with adversity in a big way, certainly not when the expectations were out there at a high level. And so as a result, if they could stumble early, then it turns into a snowball. I think they're going to be a snowball one way or the other, right? Is it going to be an avalanche that leads to failure, or is it going to be a positive avalanche, which I don't even know what a positive avalanche is, yeah. But the analogy is here that all of it builds off of like one small pebble, right? Once it gets rolling, the momentum is either going to be tremendous success or tremendous disaster. I don't think there's going to be a middle ground.
Yeah, my biggest question, I think, there's a whole lot of volatility. There's a whole lot of new there for Freddie Kitchens, for Odell, for Kareem Hunt when he comes back off of his suspension, with a young defense of Myles Garrett. There's a lot of personalities, and I haven't even mentioned Juice Landry, who was also sort of a star last year on Hard Knocks. But my biggest question is, what happens to Odell Beckham once he realizes Baker Mayfield's the one everybody cares about? Because Odell Beckham talks about how much he loves football, and he might, but he also loves himself being in the spotlight. And he's going to be relegated to page two if the page one story is almost always going to be Baker Mayfield. To me, that might be the biggest dichotomy on this team is, how in the world does Odell deal with not being the center of attention at all times like he was with the Giants?
Yeah, I do think that the challenge that he's got is ultimately it's a quarterback-driven league. And no matter how good a wide receiver is, and I think Antonio Brown is finding this out, I mean, the best player on a team has never been, to win a Super Bowl, has never been the wide receiver. Now, people out there are going to pick apart this thing. So, with Jerry Rice, no, Joe Montana, right? There has never been in the history of the NFL a situation where the best player on a team was a wide receiver. It's not going to happen with Antonio Brown. If the Raiders are good, it's going to be because Derek Carr returns to his MVP-like form before his injury. If the Cleveland Browns win at a high level this year, it's going to be because Baker Mayfield is flat-out phenomenal. Odell Beckham Jr. is a accompaniment to that. He's not the big stake, right? The stake is always the quarterback. This is my thing with Dak. It's why I wouldn't give big money to Dak, because I don't think ultimately that Dak Prescott is flat-out good enough, and we'll find out exactly how good this guy is kind of going forward. I think year two, sophomore season in the NFL, everybody's had time to look at your film. Everybody's had ability to figure out what you do well and what you don't do well. And I think this is our opportunity to see what happens. But I love the fact that the Cleveland Browns are going to be the CBS lead game in week one. My, how things have changed.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
Jason Martin with me here. I'm Clay Travis. And I saw this list, Sports Illustrated. It's the 150th anniversary of college football. And Sports Illustrated's coming out with a list of the greatest college towns. And so I feel like we could probably do a whole hour on this at some point. But in the meantime, they came out with their top 10. And I want to hit you with it, Jason Martin, see what you think. What cities you think were left off this list that should be higher. I've been fortunate to go around to a lot of these different college towns. So I'm going to go in reverse order here. 10th best college town in America, according to Sports Illustrated, Charlottesville, Virginia. It's obviously where the University of Virginia is. 9th best college town, College Station, Texas, where Texas A&M is. Knoxville, Tennessee, number 8 on this list, where the University of Tennessee is. Oxford, Mississippi, Ole Miss is there. Boulder, Colorado, where the University of Colorado is. Columbia, Missouri, where the University of Missouri is number 5, by the way. I haven't been counting very well. 4 is Ann Arbor, Michigan, where the University of Michigan is. 3 is Austin, Texas, where the University of Texas is. Athens, Georgia is number 2 on this list, where the University of Georgia is. And the number 1 college football town in America, Madison, Wisconsin. All right, so I don't want to come off the top rope on Madison, Wisconsin, but I'll just say this straight up. It ain't the number 1 college town in America.
No.
All right? It's not close. Now, Athens, Georgia as number 2. I think Athens is as perfect of a college town as exists in America. Let me explain my categories for what I think makes a great college town. First of all, it can't be a huge city. Like, so I understand Austin, Texas may be great. Where I live, Nashville, Tennessee is also great. It is a great town to be in if you are a young college graduate. But it's also a city, right? Like Knoxville, Tennessee is a city to me as well. Athens, Georgia, not a city, right? To me, to have a great college town, it has to actually be a town. It can't be a city. Madison, Wisconsin is also too big. Austin, Texas, too big. Knoxville, Tennessee, too big. Just like Nashville, Tennessee is too big. So Madison, Wisconsin is not in the running here. To me, it needs to be a town. But it needs to be a town that has a close city in proximity, which makes Athens perfect. Because if you've ever been to Athens, Georgia, it's not that far outside of Atlanta. So you get the college town experience, but if you were want to, for instance, go back to a big city, you're not that far away. So I would say Athens, in my opinion, is the best college town in America. What do you think is the best college town in America in your experience? And obviously, you haven't been to every single one. So yeah, we're not saying that necessarily we've been to every single one. I've been to a lot of them, by the way. So that would be kind of my breakdown. What would you say?
I think that's a good one. I mean, I look at Charlottesville, and that one's close to my heart because I grew up going to Charlottesville with my dad and his best friend
great
and his
town.
Daughter. I loved it. I mean, we went to Scott Stadium every
year. By the
year.
Way, how is Chapel Hill not on this list?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I went to NC State, so I was in Chapel Hill a lot of the time. It's tremendous, and that's the only thing in that city. You know about Franklin Street, and you know about the Dean Dome, and you know about their football stadium and that school, and that's it. And I think that that's important as well. If there's one that I see that's not on here that I could see on here, and I could also see maybe Columbus, Ohio or something like that, but
Columbus too big.
Yeah, okay. I think Baton Rouge is one that I would put on here. I mean, LSU is kind of incredible.
Baton Rouge is great. It's too big. Again, I mean, like
really?
If you, it's too big of a city. I mean, it's the state capital of Louisiana. It's just too big of a city, in my opinion, to be on the list, much like Knoxville is too big, I think, much like Austin, Texas, Madison.
Okay.
The ones that I think are left off that I've visited and had experience in, and I'm like, this is a great college town. I think that Chapel Hill would have to be on any list that you did, the University of North Carolina. I think Clemson is pretty phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Like everything that's, this is your neck of the woods,
yeah,
right?
I lived 20 miles from that campus for 5-6 years.
I mean, it's pretty outstanding, right?
True.
I think it's I did a book called Dixielander Light where I went around to all the SEC stadiums. As much as I like Texas A&M, College Station is not one of the 10 best college towns in America.
What about State College, Pennsylvania?
State College, Pennsylvania is pretty phenomenal. I loved it. Went up there, watched the Ohio State-Penn State game last year. I think it should be on the list. I think it's a great example of one that should be on the list. When I think of college towns, I think of places that are distinct universes, where when you're on that campus, you think, man, this place is amazing. I really feel like I have a unique feel here. I'll give you another one. Palo Alto, where Stanford is. Absolutely extraordinary college town, great environment, walking around that campus. Palo Alto is a decent size, but you feel like you're in like kind of a college bubble when you're in that area right around Stanford's campus. I think it should be on the list. I'm running through, you know, it's such an interesting list that Sports Illustrated put together. I'm going to put a pin in this one, by the way. We need to just have a whole hour one day, maybe even a whole show.
Have people call in. This is a call-in topic.
Yeah, I feel like this is a great summer show that we need to dive into. But in the meantime, I wanted to hit the SI list and give you a sense for what we thought. This is Outkick, by the way. Can't wait for college football to get back here August 24th. By the way, next Wins and Losses podcast is going to be up on Sunday. Joel Klatt will be our guest. He's the lead college football voice for Fox Sports. He's also going to join us every single Friday all season, I believe beginning tomorrow. This, by the way, is Outkick. Appreciate all you guys hanging out with us. We'll continue to dive into everything in the world of sports and beyond next on Fox Sports Radio.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick, the coverage with Clay Travis, weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.